Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. The era of civility continues. Much talked about, somewhat less practice. Minnesota, Dateline, Minnesota. Democratic Farmer Labor Party, or the Democratic Farmer Labor Party. That's the party for which Keith Ellison is the AG nominee.
Yeah.
And by the way, we'll get to his divorce record being
unsealed. Did you read that yesterday?
Yeah.
Good beach read.
That party has suspended one of its comm staffers for saying that Democrats would, quote, bring Republicans to the guillotine on November 7th, unquote.
Does anybody think before they speak?
That came days after Minnesota State Representative Sarah Anderson was punched in the arm after spotting a man destroying Republican yard signs. She said the attack left her scarred, and her attacker only desisted when she fled to her car and threw it in reverse. It was just insane. He was charging at me saying, "Why don't you go kill yourself?" To have someone physically coming after you and attacking you is just disheartening. Yeah, I'd say. And also, first-time GOP state representative candidate Shane Meckeland suffered a concussion. This is all in Minnesota.
Oh, my gosh.
After getting sucker punched while speaking with constituents at a restaurant. He suffered memory loss. Doctors telling him he'll have 4 to 6 week recovery time ahead of him. He said he was cold cocked while sitting at a high top table at a local eatery and hit his head on the floor. I was so overtaken by surprise and shock, as if this is the new norm. And if this is the new norm, it's not what I signed up for. And
people
then
getting a little testy.
Then you had George Lopez at Hooters.
Oh, what? It's fantastic. Did you watch it?
George Lopez. Sunday night at a Hooters in New Mexico, and apparently from these phony academic papers that were published in reputedly serious academic journals, we now know why heterosexual men go to Hooters.
Oh, okay.
That was
good.
One of the offerings. Yes, yeah. Very insane.
I go to Hooters for the wings. I mean, I know they didn't do a study about why women go, but if they did, that would be the answer.
Same reason.
Yeah.
Men, women, same reason. It's the wings.
Actually, the beer's pretty good there, too. Cold beer.
Yeah.
I like cold beer.
I don't know if that's a real separator. I don't know. There's, you know.
Well, there's some establishments that have okay cold beer and then really cold, awesome beer. And Hooters has that. I'm sorry. It's
okay,
too.
Kavanaugh. Okay. I got you. You like beer.
I like beer. I
we get it.
What do you drink? What do you drink?
So he's at this Hooters in New Mexico. And this has been characterized as some guy there was trolling George Lopez, knowing that he doesn't like Trump. And this is what was captured on this guy who heckled Lopez a bit on his phone.
Here comes my boy, George.
Jorge Lopez.
He's a badass. Look at him. He wants to fight me.
Hello.
George wants to fight me. George wants to fight me.
I mean, it's not funny because what the hell is George Lopez doing losing his business and grabbing this guy, trying to physically accost him, grabbing him by the neck. The guy says he only approached Lopez at his table once to ask for a pic, and he said Lopez grabbed his phone and started filming his own crotch.
Okay.
It's classy. Also, so
Christmas comes early.
Yeah, because he's a riot. I mean, George Lopez is another example. I don't understand his career.
No, I watched one of his shows once in El Paso, and it was lukewarm.
I don't understand Kevin Hart's career. I don't understand George Lopez's.
Kevin Hart though bounced back in Jumanji. He was so good in Jumanji.
Jumanji. The plural.
Faberge. Yes. Uh-huh. He was good in that.
What year was that?
That was last year. Well, that was a remake.
Oh, they did a remake of Jumanji.
And he was really good in it because he was whiny, cry, little baby guy. And it was perfect role for him.
Okay, so I still don't understand. I basically didn't understand anything you just said. So I still don't understand Kevin Hart's career. I don't understand George Lopez's. And I also don't understand Cat Williams. So if we're just talking about stand-up comedians, I don't get it.
All right?
I just don't get it. Perhaps it's me. I doubt it, though. Lopez... this guy says of Lopez, the guy said on the count of three, say, make America great again. This guy says he was just sort of, you know, having it on with Lopez because he knows he hates Trump. This guy says that he's a Democrat and he's a registered Democrat. The guy that videoed him and sort of baited him. Mm. Yeah. A little jumpy in the closing days of the campaign, or just frankly, just even in the era of Trump's presidency. But, you know, it's all kind of silliness and fun until you see people in, you know, black bandanas covering their face, directing traffic in Portland, Oregon, and spilling out into the streets, in front of bars to have fights with.
My mom's in Portland right now. She called me yesterday. And she said, I understand liberalism because I was born and raised in Chicago, but this is scary. She's like, this is militant out here. And if I told anybody there that I voted for President Trump, I'd be in fear for my life.
Yeah, that's crazy.
I've never been there. She's visiting family members, and she said it's unlike anything she's ever seen.
There's veritable obsession by the D.C. press corps for a handful of screwball white supremacists protesting anywhere, including Charlottesville, because you had that idiot murderer kill that woman. Know. And so that's terrible.
Right.
But then all of this other stuff, too, and people feeling like they can't say I voted for Trump or they can't have a position that runs counter to the mob in certain places or in certain contexts. I don't know. I think it's getting less funny.
Well, I'll tell you, I was in Hawaii. That's where I've been the past few days watching the Iron Man was staying at an Airbnb with this trainer who was such an anti-Trumper that, are you ready for this? He was tracking Hurricane Michael to see how many Trump voters it could kill. And I'm not making this up, because the next day I went up to him and I said, are you trying to be provocative or is this, you know? He said, no. He said 11 are dead, I think, 10 or 11 are dead at this point. Sure, the number's going to go higher, but these are Trump supporters. We have to get rid of them somehow, some way. And then the next day I said, well, do you know an 11-year-old girl died and a firefighter died? And the 11-year-old girl was not registered to vote. So are you having any? He said, well, her parents were probably Trump supporters, so I hope they're in a great deal of pain.
Yeah.
And guess what I did? I left and checked into a hotel.
Well, I mean, it's...
I'm not going to put up with that crap, and that's scary stuff.
It's just the
you're wishing people to die. Latest and voted for Trump.
Latest installment of the left exposing themselves as having nothing but hate to offer, and this goes back to the Shelby Steele column from a couple of weeks ago that in the Wall Street Journal that distilled this. That's all they have to offer at this point is hatred, because they can't sell what they otherwise want to do if they were transparent about it. So they have to balkanize while preaching unity. It's classic, paint by numbers cultural Marxism.
All right.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. AM 560. The Answer.
Dan and Amy were talking about political violence or violence. Inspired by politics, George Lopez attacking a dude at a Hooters in New Mexico. Okay.
That's when you know your career is taking a turn. When you're eating at Hooters in New Mexico.
State rep and GOP state rep candidate both assaulted in Minnesota. Yeah, it's testy times. Bruno in Naperville, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, the extreme left wing of the Democrat Party has manifested by Antifa and those guys. They are exactly the same people. They are exactly the same people who were the Bolsheviks in the late 19-teens and early 1920s who turned the Russian Revolution into Soviet communism. And people should have absolutely no doubt that if that group ever got into power, they would kill people who disagreed with them and who they felt were in the way of creating the utopian society that they want.
Thanks for the call, Bruno. I think it's concerning. I think it's always going to be a contact sport rhetorically, and things are going to be said. This is, people always think of, oh my gosh, the accusations flying. This has never happened in Illinois politics or national politics. This is, a campaign that's been in the gutter. If you go back and look at presidential campaigns, go back to the 1800s, go back to the 1700s, and look at how what people were accused to each other of being in the context of running for office.
So it's always been nasty.
It's always going to be nasty.
But has it always been physical like this?
Well,
I mean, Senator Susan Collins, her husband's they're getting threats because of her Kavanaugh vote on an hourly basis.
Yeah, I think there's when you have somebody attacking a United States senator while he's mowing his lawn.
Yeah, it's a big deal.
Or obviously somebody inspired by politics to open fire on a softball practice. Mm. You're getting into a dangerous. These are one-offs. I mean, this is not the whole Democrat Party and people have been inspired to behave badly because they don't like Democrats. It's not representative of an entire political party. Of course not. But there is sort of tacit acceptance of some of it. I mean, Eric Holder and Hillary Clinton's comments over the last week or so, civility's off the table. They don't even make the pretense anymore. Which actually, in sort of a perverse way, I appreciate, because when they do make the pretense, when you hear slime like Dick Durbin talking about civility and practicing something that is approximately 180 degrees from it, I'd rather you just strip away the pretense so that people can understand exactly their choice and exactly what they're endorsing when they decide to stand on the side of the skirmish line of one Dick Durbin, for example. Much less Antifa or Black Lives Matter or some of these other professional protest groups, of which there is a segment that's actually an elective office in the Democrat Party. That's a fact, as Bruno from Naperville has said.
If you're talking about it, I'll be talking about it. Dennis Prager here. Join me this morning at 11 right here on AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy, we're talking about violence in our politics, getting beyond harsh words to physical contact. Chuck and Delavan, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
The previous caller there, he was a little worried about the people like the Soviet Union people, the Bolsheviks that threw everybody and killed them. Wow. There is right now, north of the Cheddar Curtain, over 650,000 license holders that went into the woods to shoot Bambi last year, and I doubt if they just have one gun. I'm betting on my cheesehead friends up here. We have lefties up here in Wisconsin, but they're kind and gentle. They're not like the ones that are out in Oregon. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call, Chuck. Just, I'm worried about Wisconsin. Speaking of the midterms, I'm worried about Walker and Vukmir.
Yeah. What does it look like for Walker so far? With last polling?
Walker's in trouble, and Vukmir's in real trouble. And we'll effort to get them on the show for closing arguments before November 6th. But it's just one of those things with Walker. He's done such a great job, but there is political fatigue, right? It's obviously he had a very contentious first couple of years with Wisconsin seemingly holding a special election every 5 minutes.
I know. Did you feel like that?
So he weathered all those storms, and he and legislative Republicans have turned that state around. But, that's 8 years ago now. It's his third term. And there's there's some fatigue, and the landscape isn't great. And
he left to go run. But he did run for president.
Right,
tried that out, took that for a spin.
Right. So I just worry that there's some fatigue, and that may And well, it's seriously jeopardizing his chances for a third term. I hope it doesn't tube them entirely. And then I think, you know, Vukmir had a very contested primary. Wisconsin's primary is a little bit later, and I think it's just taken a lot of time to kind of reorganize and refocus and talk to the general electorate. And meanwhile, you know, the power of incumbency, Tammy Baldwin, has a pretty decent lead right now. So it's this is the thing. Hey, you know, you don't like what's happened in Wisconsin for the last 8 years? You don't like how much that state's economy has improved? How much its education has improved and opportunities for quality education? I mean, what's not to like about what has happened in Wisconsin when it comes to, particularly when it comes to fiscal issues over the last 8 years? People satiated and they, oh, well, let's just try something new. Let's try something that's not working for a change, just to mix it up.
But if they vote in a Democratic governor, are things going to go back to the way they were eventually?
Well, what do you mean? Yes, there's very different policy visions. And so if you turn Wisconsin back over to the La Follette progressive left, then what do you think is going to happen? They're going to move to do what the left is doing around this country, which is move away from capitalism, be spendthrifts, as is their want. So one sort of tied to the other. And, you know, advance cultural Marxist culture. Well, I mean, what do you think they're going to do? Where's the moderate Democrat in this country?
That's true. Where is the moderate Democrat? And the person running against him is not a moderate Democrat. I don't know much about him.
Evers, he's sort of, he's been around for a long time. He's in the education space. So it's,
isn't he an older gentleman?
Teachers union flack.
Isn't he in his 90s?
He's not old.
Not that old, but he's old.
So I mean, is that where the innovation and creativity and dynamism is coming from? The public sector unions and their handpicked candidates like Evers in Wisconsin? Is that where it's coming from? I mean,
but have they learned nothing from watching Illinois and watching Illinoisans flee to Wisconsin because of bad public policies that we have here? That's what's amazing to me.
It's remarkable. I agree. I completely agree. They're more focused like we are here, I guess, on billion-dollar lotteries.
Well, the question is are you going to buy a lotto ticket? Because this is a first where we have the Mega Millions it's at 90 million right now. It's going to be at a billion, they say,
900
tomorrow.
900 million.
900 million, excuse me. And then the Powerball rolled over last night. So now that jackpot is $430 million.
Yeah.
So do you normally play the lotto? Or do you ever play?
No.
Never. This segment is called Get to Know Your Co-Hosts.
Yeah.
You've never played?
No. Why would I play?
Because you can't win if you don't play. I don't know.
Yeah, that's a fun TV
commercial. But would this entice you to play?
Yeah, right.
$900 million.
The prospect of winning like your customary 100, 150, 200 million. I mean, what am I going to do with 150 or $200 million? I can't do anything with that. $1 billion, now I'm listening. Now I'm interested.
What are you going to do if you win?
Well, first of all, I'll quit my job. I don't get enough sleep.
Me and my wife are looking to buy a house.
I would pay off all my
debts.
I'm going to go in my room and hide for a couple of days.
The rest of my life, it's spending money.
Okay, there's a Brewster's Millions guy. That's what I like.
Isn't that the best? You buy a house.
Yeah.
You can buy a town. You'd have more money than Taylor Swift, they say.
Well, the one thing I'll say about that, though, is I actually appreciate the guy who said buy a house because it says, you know, I don't want to that much in this life. But my hopes and aspirations are reasonable.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I'd buy a nice house. Okay, fine. Great. Good. You know, maybe one of these guys would tithe, too. And there's a lot of lottery winners that have been generous, too, I mean, philanthropically.
And then there's a lot that end up homeless because they spend all their winnings and then don't, you know, talk to their family because everybody comes out of the woodworks once you win the lotto.
I'm in the Lou Holtz camp on this one.
What's that?
Lou Holtz, four things everybody has to have in life.
Okay. Use a minivan?
Win a lottery. No. Four things you have to have in life. Something to do.
Yes.
Someone to love.
I don't know about that. Well, can you love yourself? Or maybe
it's the greatest love of all. Maybe a what?
An animal, like Bunky or Hayek. Mm-hmm. All right, something to do.
Something to do, someone to love, someone to believe in. For Holtz, like me, it's Jesus Christ.
Right, yeah, that's mm-hmm. what I thought too, okay.
And something to hope for. So I guess the lottery would be in the something to hope for category, but I don't think that's what Lou Holtz is talking about. Something to hope for that's reasonable, that's feasible.
Well, I only buy one quick pick ticket. That's it for each. So I'm out $4. It's a, you know, that'll give you something to hope for.
That's a good way to put it, too. You're out $4 because that will be the result.
But I can't stand all these anchors who are on air, whether it be cable network or local TV, who say, oh, we're going to, you know, let's, you know, if they go to the reporter in the field, like, oh, I'll give you $2, buy me a ticket. You're sitting at an anchor desk. You already won the lotto. Are you serious? It's such pandering to me, and it makes me sick every time they do it.
They're regular people. They're regular Joes and Sallys.
Oh, yeah, they're just like us. Yeah. Making millions of dollars. Just like us, Dan. Yeah.
I wonder if Pritzker and Ronner will buy lottery tickets.
That's what I was thinking, too.
Dan in Libertyville.
I was listening to your earlier comments about Walker and what's happening up there and all the people from Illinois moving to Wisconsin, and that is the problem. Illinois residents are like a cancer. They bring their progressive liberal viewpoints wherever they go, be it Arizona or Florida or, you know, Texas or wherever they go to. They want to make that place like Illinois. Now, this is a microcosm of what we have coming up from Honduras and Guatemala. As those thousands and thousands and thousands of those people come here, we're going to become more like Honduras and Guatemala.
Yeah, thanks for the call, Dan. There's something to that. You know, people moved out of the city and turned the North Shore from sort of soft Republican to wild-eyed left. But there's something else. There's this culture thing that people don't appreciate enough. They just think, oh, well, the culture that you're protecting mm-hmm. or the culture that you're advocating. So Texas is a good example of this. Texas is going to be a majority minority state, Latino, and that's when it's going to go blue.
Not so fast.
Hold on. Right.
There's a lot of people in El Paso in particular that are Republicans.
Right.
A lot more than you would ever imagine.
Because the Latino population, like all these demographics that the idiocracy on cable news talk about, are not monolithic. And it turns out that as new Americans get to become second-generation Americans, you see a lot of shift in their political leanings. You know, as they assimilate. And here's the thing about the culture, like in Texas, the political culture. Politics is not central. How not central is it? Their legislature meets once every 2 years. Part-time jobs, no permanent ruling class at the state level. That's big. And so people that come to Texas assimilate into the political culture there, which is individual-centric, you know, the Republic of Texas, independent, and self-sufficient. And so it doesn't, you know, so I don't fear, nor should, and nor do I think a lot of Texas Republicans, it will become majority Latino state. It may happen. And so, fine. Then the Republican Party in Texas will become a majority Latino party. Fine. Great. That's the difference. So we always look at demographics and we say, look at this demographic and look how they vote. And that demographic is never really spliced out like it should be to see differences in voting patterns between different ethnicities, between when you're talking about immigration, new Americans and second and third generation Americans versus first generation Americans. And so it's a much more complicated picture. But it all goes back to culture. What is the political culture under which you're suffering or thriving? And obviously we're suffering here because we've got a kleptocracy. Mm-hmm. And Texas is thriving because they don't, because they're not government-centric the way Illinois is. So I wish we would spend more time talking about our poisonous political culture than individual demographics that just fold into the poison, that just get poisoned like everybody else has been poisoned. And so the Wisconsin problem, there's Illinoisans that are fleeing here to go to Wisconsin. But there's also Illinoisans fleeing here to go to Indiana. And I don't see Indiana's political culture changing all that much. you know, the Donnelly Braun race, notwithstanding however that shakes out. I just don't see it changing that much. So I just think there's a deeper thing there. And don't forget, I mean, that's been the big indictment of Illinois. Walker and Republicans can get elected and turn Wisconsin around in a state with a much deeper hard left tradition, La Follette progressivism, for goodness sakes. I mean, I know it's the birthplace of the Republican Party, too. But I mean, really, in terms of political culture, this discussion, La Follette is more dominant. And we can't do that here? Of course we can. But Walker and Republicans charted a different course for the Republican Party, building off the success 20 years earlier of Tommy Thompson's tenure. Oh. And we have done nothing of the sort. And that turns out to matter.
AM 560, The Answer.
I still can't believe that you're not going to buy a lotto ticket. I got a text message from my neighbor saying it's going to be $1 billion. What's $2? Is that just buying into the system?
Yeah, it's the principle of the thing. I mean, why would I, if I, would ask a question. If I pay no attention to it when it's $200 or $300 million, why would I pay attention to it when it's $1 billion? What's the difference except the odds continue to deteriorate? Except I have a better chance of being eaten by a shark twice and struck by lightning.
Exactly. One in 292 million of a chance to win.
Yeah. Yeah. I know, but if you don't win, you can't play. You show.
But would you come to work if you won the lotto?
I go back to Lou Holtz. People need something to do.
Something to love.
Something
to love. I love myself.
Something. Someone to believe in. Something to hope for. Okay. I hope for Scott Walker and Leah Vukmir's re-election. Scott Walker's re-election and Leah Vukmir's election in Wisconsin.
Okay.
It's one of the places I'm considering relocating to. By the way, speaking of these dollar figures, you know, we wring our hands over the money spent in politics. 2018 elections to spend will be $5.2 billion.
What? That's more than the lotto jackpot.
$1 billion more than in 2016. Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah. And so is there too much money in politics? Too much spend on politics? Well, by comparison, you know how much Americans spend on lottery tickets annually?
Oh, I don't know how much. Because you're not a part of that.
$80 billion.
$80 billion? Mm-hmm. A year? That would be annually.
You know how much Americans spend on beer?
Oh, this is great. Let me guess. $1 billion?
$95 billion.
Well, I was really off on that.
You know how much Americans spend on porn?
$95 billion.
$11 billion. Those numbers are a bit old, though. Couple of years old. You know how much how much is spent on marketing, meaning advertising, potato chips to Americans?
$10 billion?
$6 billion. So we spend, there's more money spent to market potato chips, to market Fritos to Americans than is collectively spent by the two major parties on elections. So, I mean, just some context when you kind of fall into the conventional wisdom crowd and, you know, are all aghast. Like these idiotic organizations like the Illinois campaign, Common Cause types, too much money in our politics. More money spent to market Ruffles to you. And admittedly, a bag of Ruffles has more definition and character than a lot of the politicians we spend money on.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. What do Donald Trump and Mike Madigan have in common?
A lot of power. Mm-hmm. Money.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The majority. I don't know.
In an Illinois context, neither one of them is going to lower your property taxes. Trump, because that's not in his purview. Madigan, because that's not in his interest. And I just wonder, now that we're just over 2 weeks out from the midterms, are people in the suburbs connecting the dots? People in particular in the suburbs, suburban voters, are you connecting the dots as your mailbox is deluged with the typical every 2 years, like the swallows returning to Capistrano, mailers of extremist agenda, NRA, and unpopular Republican du jour. This time it's Trump, and to some extent Rauner, but particularly Trump. Right.
Yeah, every commercial, I mean, it's always, they associate
every Republican is Trump. A Trump Republican, because yes. Trump's numbers are bad in the suburbs, and so you're supposed to believe that Peter Breen and Lombard and Tom Morrison and Palatine and Mark Badnick and Plainfield, everybody is a Trump toady. They're waiting to see what Trump does so they can mimic him at the state level. But does anybody actually believe that? Well, apparently they do. Or maybe they're just Democrats and they don't care. That the second part of that, the latter argument, I understand. The if you consider yourself like an open-minded, independent type of person, and you're buying the argument that Mike Madigan and Spalding are selling about these legislative candidates, then you don't really quite get it, do you? And it's interesting because Spalding is doing his best to keep former Governor Bruce Rauner in this race, not only with the property tax fraud that he committed, and he did commit it, and not only, and John Cass pointed this out, Chicago Tribune columnist, friend mm-hmm. of the show. Check him out, Latest Against the Current interview at upstream-ideas.com. Do a little pre-election preview. Not only did he commit property tax fraud, he used his wife as a human shield when he got called out. He said, oh, it was my wife's decision. Send her to jail.
Oh, my gosh.
I mean, he's slimy. Of course he is. Of course he is.
Has he ever had a real job? I mean, if
he was raised by a single mother, Amy,
who was an alcoholic, and I, what you know, I'm not bashing that. I mean, I respect that she had to deal with her disease, but yeah, that's he's got that. But besides that,
it's a real riches to riches story.
I mean, were they living paycheck to paycheck? Because he made it sound like they were so downtrodden, and you know, she was kicked out of the family business because of her drinking problem.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. I'm in a position where I'm not going to let that happen again. I'm going to help people.
Yeah, it's not exactly the most compelling Horatio Alger story I've ever heard. I'll just put it that way.
Because if he gets elected governor, which it's looking like that, he's going to be a mascot. He's not going to be a leader. Mike Madigan is going to be still run the state, and he's going to be the guy that shows up at parades and can be hired for parties. And don't you agree? I mean, what's he going to bring to the table? What kind of intellect does he have? What kind of political prowess does he have?
He wants to wear the sash.
Yeah, the mascot.
And, you know, the problem is that that's what most Republicans in the state want to do, too, at the leadership level, the people with titles. And until that changes, you're going to have sort of this dismal kleptocracy and Republicans in the super minority. But there are shining stars out there. There are people in the Republican Party that are trying to change it. And you know who they are because they're being targeted with lies. So Sam McCann, Conservative mm-hmm. Party candidate for governor, who we've had on this show, and I've asked him to come on the show again. He couldn't do today, but he said he'll do tomorrow, so we'll see.
Okay.
He's sending out mailers hitting Rauner. Fine, you want to hit Rauner. You know, I get it. And then also saying, don't vote for Rauner Rhinos, you know, Republican in name only. Like Tom Morrison and Palatine.
Why did he lump Tom Morrison in there?
Here's what I think is happening. He's being backed by Operating Engineers Local 150. Operating Engineers Local 150 is folded completely in with Madigan. And so they're using Sam McCann as a conduit to hit Tom Morrison to help Mike Madigan pick up and pick off suburban
seats.
And Tom Morrison, I mean, just so we understand, and I will put this to Sam McCann if he comes on the show tomorrow, Tom Morrison is the most, I mean, in addition to Jeannie Ives, who's outgoing,
right,
the most principled conservative in the General Assembly. And one of those principled conservatives in the state. It's not even a close call. Oh, by the way, so if you're in the Palatine area and you're getting these mailers from Sam McCann, I mean, Morrison endorsed and was a surrogate for Jeannie Ives in the primary, and he is completely transparent about his positions on things. He articulates why he supports them across the board, fiscal and moral. And the result of these mailers was that the Illinois Family Institute, their action arm, their C4 arm, withdrew their endorsement of Sam McCann yesterday. So if you get these, like, a conservative party, you know, this is easy to snow people because they don't pay attention. If you get these mailers with Sam McCann being used as a tool of Mike Madigan through the operating engineers who are paying for Sam McCann's mail to attack conservative incumbents like Tom Morrison or Peter Breen or Mark Batnick in the suburbs, understand that it's a lie, that it is a proxy for Mike Madigan, and they're just trying to peel off a couple of percentage points of conservatives who are gullible enough to believe the lies in Sam McCann's mail to pick up those seats.
Okay, so during that gubernatorial debate on Channel 7 when Governor Rauner said, you're being paid off, you're being financed by Mike Madigan, he said that to Sam McCann. He wasn't that off then.
He's off in a sense because the problem is Operating Engineers Local 150, they've given a lot of money to Republicans, too. They've given more than $500,000 to Jim Durkin. If that's the standard, so then whoever they give money to is mm-hmm. a Mike Madigan flag. No, that's not the standard historically. I'm saying in this instance, this is what's happening because there is no credible case to make. Just as Bruce Rauner failed the integrity test when he spent $20 million in the primary to say that Jeannie Ives is Mike Madigan's favorite Republican, he's failed the integrity test. I mean, he failed the integrity test before with his policy choices, right. But then he closed that door. He ended that argument. There is no argument to be made on behalf of Bruce Rauner on that score of integrity. And now there's no argument to be made for Sam McCann.
So this federal lawsuit was filed yesterday against J.B. Pritzker's campaign. 10 staff members claim that they were hired to fill a race quota and do specific race-related duties. And they also claim that white staff members were treated better. Do you think this is going to have any legs? Is this going to affect his campaign?
It's such a weird lawsuit. Rich Miller over at Capital Facts, which is one of these sort of inside the bubble rags.
Oh, yeah.
He posted a tweet from one of the plaintiffs in that complaint.
Yeah.
The day after the lawsuit was filed. And it's a picture of her at a Pritzker campaign rally. Had an amazing night tonight at the Step Down Cafe in Pilsen, Chicago Proud. Hashtag Team JB, at Juliana for LG, at JB Pritzker. So she didn't seem so upset about it.
She didn't seem so victimized by that.
You know, the thing about it is, I know we have a very difficult time ascribing less than redeemable motives to people. Some people are grifters. And I have no sympathy, believe me, for Spalding and Stratton because they're being cannibalized by their own. They're being cannibalized by their own poisonous, identity-laden politics.
Well, they claim that they were herded into race-specific positions,
uh-huh.
offered no meaningful chance for advancement, and received less favorable treatment than their white counterparts.
Yeah.
They said it's a cesspool of racial discrimination and harassment.
Yawn. By the way, every campaign, as far as I can, I mean, every campaign at that level, every office at that level has African-American liaison, right. Latino liaison. Lisa Madigan's office had it.
Yeah, every
and the previous governors have had it.
Right.
So, I mean, this is the idiocy, the intellectual depravity of identity politics. And the fact that it's being visited upon Pritzker and Stratton is called karma.
Well, Governor Rauner, you know, they asked him, were you instrumental in having these people file the lawsuit?
He used the language of racists in that phone call, and he was on
that
tape.
Was the wrong bite. But he said, no, he had absolutely nothing to do with it, and he has had his nose out of that campaign.
It's happening in the city, too, the cannibalization. It's sort of fun to watch. Maybe some people have to learn some hard lessons. Pat O'Connor, 40th Ward Alderman.
Yeah.
One of the candidates running against him is of Nigerian descent. And O'Connor is being accused of being a racist because he's criticized a flyer that his opponent, his name is O'Carey, put out that that sort of promotes Nigerian political power. O'Carey responds that, guess what, there are different constituencies across the city of Chicago. Every single one deserves political power. And then O'Carey called O'Connor racist. The moderator of this candidate forum where they were both at, where this came up, after the forum, tweeted that Alderman Pat O'Connor is a racist troll who is morally unfit for public office for accusing his Nigerian-American opponent of not being for the community but for Nigerians. I mean, it's all self-inflicted wounds. I just hope that, there's enough survivors of identity politics to push back against the identity politics predators. And that's what these people are. Mark in Des Plaines, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
You know, in this discussion this morning, I just wanted to mentioned Marilyn Smolinski in the 55th District. I mean, Marty Moylan is the biggest shill for for Madigan, and he always votes with him on every issue. Marilyn comes along. She's a non-politician, just a regular mom, you know, like you, Amy. Come on. I mean, you know, most people don't want somebody who holds up their fist and says, who do we like? Mike, you know, like in that video that's been going around on the internet. And really, that's what Moylan is. He just votes with Madigan, lockstep every time, and that's where we are. And it's just ridiculous. And I just wanted to give Marilyn a shout-out because she's trying to change this, and there's so many people here. Look, you know, it's hopeless unless we get new people in there who are. And Marilyn's for term limits, you know.
Yeah, all right. Thanks for the call, Mark. Appreciate it. Yeah, Smolinski.
Can we have Marilyn call in?
Smolinski is a candidate I'm backing, so in the interest of full disclosure. And she's fantastic. And this is another, it's just you put the question to people. You just put the question to people. In Park Ridge and Des Plaines and a part of Elk Grove, that's the district that Mark and Des Plaines is talking about. That's the district. I mean, do you like what's going on? You think Marty's a good guy because he, you know, rides his bicycle to your block party and then goes down to Springfield and does Madigan's bidding? How are your property taxes out there?
Poof.
I mean,
they're ridiculous at Park Ridge.
So that's just, it's just a question. Do you want to change the course for the state or not? And if you don't, then you don't. Fine. I get it. Then you'll have your way. And people will have their way. People that have the ability to make a change in their life that's independent of their neighbors' voting habits. And the state will get worse, including for your kids. And they won't be here once they get out of high school. So if that's the future you want, then it's on the ballot. Speaking of property taxes, we've talked a lot about like high-profile people. Athletes trying to get out from underneath mansions. Kirk Heinrich, Brian Urlacher, Scottie Pippen. How about just regular people? We talked a lot about that too, but here's one. Fred Hampton Jr. soliciting donations to help him stave off foreclosure of his father's boyhood home in Maywood. Black Panther leader Fred Hampton, of course.
I've met Fred Hampton Jr. He's trying to get people to pay his property taxes?
Well,
his father's?
His dad's home is, according to Cook County, worth $141,000.
All right. What are the property taxes?
$8,400.
What?
6% of home value. So it's worth nothing is basically the answer. It has zero market value. Courtesy of Cook County government. Courtesy of Cook County Democrats, courtesy of Chicago Democrats, courtesy of Mike Madigan and all his suburban lackeys. Do you get it? For goodness sakes. The tax bill spiked more than 400% this year to more than $8,000 after his uncle passed away. And the you know, freezes and benefits for seniors went with him. So, I mean, you know, it's funny. Oak Park River Forest High School teacher and Socialist Party leader, of course. It's redundant. I already said he was a teacher at Oak Park River Forest. Anthony Clark has started a Comrades for Fred Hampton Home GoFundMe page. Mm-hmm.
That's what we're going to do now. GoFundMe pages to pay our property taxes?
Well, here's the thing. It's the left being mugged by the left, too. This is another example of it. So the left being mugged by the left with racial discrimination accusations against Pat O'Connor, lawsuit against Spalding and his running mate, and also the liquidation of Fred Hampton Sr.'s home. You see, for those on the left, and you go tell your friends of them on the left, you're not going to escape your own terrible public policies, your own poisonous politics. It will come for you, too. Jim in Tampa, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning. I love it when you get on this topic and you just give facts and figures. My house is worth a little over $300,000. Last year, our taxes were $2,250. And we moved out of Hillsborough County, where Tampa actually is, in the adjacent county, because we were alarmed that our taxes had risen over $4,000. We just thought that was ridiculous. It's just a perspective. But this is very powerful stuff, the way you talk about these property taxes.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jim. Appreciate it.
By the way, $1,595,000 raised so far to save the Hampton house.
$1,500.
Yeah,
$1,500. Yeah. Mike on the north side.
Good morning, kids. Hi. Dan, I can't believe you're being so racially insensitive. First off, why would you single out the people working for Buddy Hackett Jr.'s gubernatorial campaign as grifters? That describes every patronage worker of the Democratic Party. I mean, if women are supposed to be believed, like in the Kavanaugh case, shouldn't we postpone the gubernatorial election until a full FBI investigation can be launched? I mean, minority women, immigrant women, are still on strike against Pritzker's Hotel. And if you read the papers, the first hotel to settle with the strikers was Marriott, owned by the Republicans. I mean, all these people deserve a right to be heard in front of Congress because of what Pritzker is doing to them.
Okay, thanks for the call, Maisie Hirano from the North Side. Appreciate it.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer. Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy continues now. And make sure to stay tuned to catch me, Mike Gallagher, coming up at 9, only on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So the odds of winning the billion-dollar lottery are what?
Well, if you win both the Mega Millions and the Powerball, the odds are 1 in 88 quadrillion.
88 quadrillion.
Yeah. Which Mike Scott said is 15 zeros.
That's about the same as the odds that Crown Prince MBS didn't know about the murder and dismemberment of one Jamal Khashoggi. Still dealing with this issue is the Trump administration. Difficult issue because of the geopolitical importance of Saudi Arabia in the Middle East and this arms deal that we just secured with them.
Mm-hmm.
But Trump is getting some real criticism from some usual suspects, but nonetheless, Max Boot writing in the Washington Post, Trump has given every despot on the planet a license to kill. Does Boot Trump's rhetoric. President Xi of China is great. Duterte in the Philippines is doing an unbelievable job on the drug problem. Erdogan in Turkey. He was congratulating Erdogan in Turkey for winning the rigged referendum. He declared his love for Kim Jong-un and North Korea, talking about how they get along.
Right.
And this is all evidence Max Boot suggests that the only thing that matters, his words, the only thing that matters to this intensely solipsistic president is how other rulers treat him, how they treat their own people or even their neighbors is irrelevant. And I don't think that's really fair because there's Trump's rhetoric. And then there's Trump's actions. And when it comes to his actions to unwind the Iran nuclear deal, when it comes to his actions to impose sanctions on Putin, even while rhetorically he says, we get along, we had a good meeting there in Scandinavia a couple months back, and there's different things. So he's, you know, Norman Vincent Peale, always on the positive with respect to his relationships with people who are otherwise constructively engaging him, he believes. But it doesn't mean that, that always translates into policies that is favorable, policies that are favorable to them or their country. And Iran and Russia and China, tariffs on China, I should add, are three pretty powerful examples. For more on this topic, we're pleased to be joined again by James Carafano, Lieutenant Colonel James Carafano, U.S. Army veteran, author of the book Surviving the End, as well as Wiki at War, Conflict in a Socially Networked World. Jim, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Good to be with you.
So how do you assess the president's handling of the Khashoggi matter and also, if you would, address Max Boot's criticism of President Trump?
You know, I thought the way you framed it was appropriate. I mean, I think what the U.S. does is a combination of rhetoric and action, and you have to look at both of them to understand U.S. policy. I think the problem is you can have any Trump you want if you cherry-pick a comment or a statement and then try to devolve the policy from there. But you have to look at the context of everything we're doing and then try to put Trump's comments in context. You know, he is a strategic communicator, but he uses his communications for different reasons at different times. You know, sometimes it's like the good cop, bad cop you see on Law and Order. You know, Trump is delivering the positive message, but he has other people delivering the not so positive message. So I think you have to be more statesmanlike than Max's assessment and actually evaluate them like a statesman. On this, I would say right now, and what's going on with the Saudis, I think the U.S. is doing the right thing. We do have to worry about our credibility and how people view our actions, and we should take our actions based on facts. And for all the reporting that's been the last week, we actually don't have any more concrete facts than we had on almost day one of this crisis, which is we can believe that he went into the consulate. We can believe that nobody has seen him since, but almost everything else is based on reporting, leaks, comments, promises. And I think that for the credibility of the United States, we have to be better than that.
Well, so
we have to make policy based on what we can actually prove. I thought, just to say, you know, what the British did with the Skripal poisoning incident, that was a textbook in how it's supposed to be done. The British did a credible investigation, and then it was easy to rally world support for that because it was credible, it was transparent, it was provable.
So the gut-wrenching information that Turkish officials allegedly leaked or gave to CNN, you believe could be fake news? I mean, they said that it took 7 minutes to cut up his body, and the lead guy put on music, put on headphones, and suggested others put on headphones while they dismember him, and that he was alive during the process.
Do you know?
No.
Yeah, we don't. I mean, this is a murder investigation, and you know, and I think we have to treat it like a real murder investigation, and I think that has to drive U.S. policy. And people want to do all kinds of things. Look, I think Congress should be involved. We might look at the different actions we might take, but Congress is not even going to come back and look at this until after the midterm elections. So we have several weeks to get a lot more facts and a lot more information and make a lot more sober policy. This issue isn't going anywhere, and I think it's as important that the U.S. get it right as that we get it fast.
It's interesting what the D.C. press corps does, right? They report more and more salacious details in lieu of actual substantiation for the leaked information. So, I mean, you know, they could have been listening to Dirty Deeds Done Dirt Cheap. That's what we're going to hear next. You know, oh, my gosh. The more responsible position seems to me actually taken by Graham Wood over the Atlantic, which is Turkey should release the Khashoggi tapes. So he doesn't want to hear him, but somebody should hear him. Forensic investigators should hear him. What do you think about that?
Well, I think we should have sent Pompeo to Turkey and Riyadh. We should have sent the FBI director, and sending the message that we want a credible investigation and an appropriate release of facts and information. You know, we're always bashing the press. I had a reporter from the news outlet call me yesterday and said, you know, I've got 14 rumors right here in front of me. What do I do with these? Because right. I can't verify any of this. How do I report on any of this? And to their credit, you know, I've been looking at his byline and you know, they're not just reporting on every single rumor and spin that comes across their desk. I think that's really responsible journalism.
Yeah, sure.
Some read an article on that.
Sure, it's not like they're not treating the Saudis like they treated Kavanaugh. So that's encouraging.
You know, I think there are analogies to this. I know Trevor, what's his name, went after Trump for raising that, but I think it's we should let the facts drive the policy. You know, I get these innumerable questions about, well, what should we do? What should we do? Well, actually, you know, if a malicious act was done and the government doesn't deal with it responsibly, there's actually a lot in U.S. law that says what we can and what we should do. Actually, executing the policy is the easy part once we know the facts.
Well, what did you make about his last op-ed that was published today in the Washington Post where he, you know, was pushing for an offering, would like to have a free press in Saudi Arabia?
Well, I mean, this is why this is an issue to begin with. I mean, he was a strident critic of the administration. And in turn, the administration actually, you know, tried to engage with him. And that got him more attention and actually made him more influential. And the relationship between them became more antagonistic. So clearly the Saudis had an axe to grind with this guy. And so that does speak to motive. And I think that's why I think people are realistically concerned about what the government may not have done. So, and that's why this is an issue to begin with.
All right. I want to continue to engage in reckless speculation here, but in a different topic. Mueller reportedly ready to deliver the findings of his Trump probe shortly after the midterm elections. Rod Rosenstein giving an interview to the Wall Street Journal yesterday, essentially defending the legitimacy of Mueller's investigation, calling it appropriate and independent. What do you anticipate from the forthcoming Mueller report?
Yeah. Good luck getting me to speculate on that.
Oh, come on.
You know, what is the virtue of speculating when, you know, we will know the results of the report relatively?
I want to know now. Yeah. Oh, we don't have attention spans. I want what I want when I want it, Jim.
Yeah.
All right, fine.
Yeah. You know. Good luck on that. You know.
What about the investigation itself?
Regardless of what the result of this is, you know, you need to think long and carefully before you appoint a special counsel. Hmm. There is an appropriate. We just had a great event on this on Heritage. It's on Heritage.org. People can go back and look at the tape. There's an appropriate role for a special counsel. And I just think you need to take that, and it's very, very seriously. And this is, I think, a case study in being thoughtful about the decision to appoint one to begin with. And maybe that's the conversation we should have after we get this results. It has nothing to do with what they conclude or anything else, but whether that was the right instrument to begin with.
All right. He is Jim Carafano. He's the director of the Douglas and Sarah Allison Center for Foreign Policy Studies at the Heritage Foundation, also U.S. Army veteran. Books include Surviving the End and Wiki at War, Conflict in a Socially Networked World. Jim, thanks as always for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one. Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. The question, is sports important enough in your life? Not that it's important enough, meaning it should be important. Are you making it enough of a priority?
I think I make it too much of a priority.
Well, okay.
Because as we're talking, I'm looking at our statistics because who we play tonight, see what their winning average is. And
your volleyball
just making sure
teams.
That we're on top, which we are. We are 5-0 so far. We'll be 6-0 after tonight, yes. Well, but this isn't about middle school girls volleyball.
Well, of course, I mean, in a sense it is, but of course you've got the ALCS and NLCS going on right now. You've got Blackhawks and Bulls starting their seasons. You've got the Bears playing pretty good football.
Bears. They always do horrible after a bye week. Have you noticed that?
Hmm. Yeah. Tyler Cohen writes in, for Bloomberg, the NBA is just what 2018 needs. Longstanding tradition of among American intellectuals to be enamored with baseball from Philip Roth and George Will. But Cohen makes a couple of arguments on behalf of sports as part of your life. Following at least one sports team can help remind us what objective thinking feels like. For example, Cohen, who's an economist at George Mason University. Sometimes I use sports examples to think through economics or managerial problems. Have you ever wondered why the use of the three-point shot in the NBA is still rising and why Golden State and Houston have been so successful with it? It wasn't introduced until 79. It's taken the sport decades to fully exploit its potential. And many experts argue teams like the Bucks and the Wizards haven't adjusted their strategies sufficiently. He talks about the rigidity for change that has nothing to do with government. It's, you know, cultural within a game as it pertains to rule changes. I mean, remember like Paul Westhead with the Suns and with Loyola Marymount doing like a fast break, all three pointers, no defense. The no defense turned out to be a problem, but sort of to some extent ahead of his time with what you see from the Golden State Warriors, for example. He says, secondly, in addition to being a good default conversation topic, sports also keeps us in touch with the strands of American life that many of us may not encounter otherwise. Following basketball gives me new entry points into rap music, sneaker contracts, college athletics, gifts, the economics of television, even Twitter. So it just opens up another world that you're perhaps not otherwise in or get regular exposure to in your professional life, and particularly as an academic, you know. Mm-hmm. So, you know, this is like kind of, you know, being well-rounded in a sense.
Right.
And you may find out that you're interested. You may find out that as you learn about a particular sport, it has applications. And he also...
Well, it teaches you about the rules of life and just, you know, that if you practice hard, there are rewards. And that if you work hard in school, then you can play. Because academics was important to me, but it also, you had to keep up a certain grade point average to play your sport. That helps with you becoming a better rounded person.
And a lot of people, you know, on this show, obviously we focus on politics and culture. Yes. And so we talk about sports. People go, oh, I don't want to talk about sports. I don't care about this because this guy's kneeling and so on and so forth. But sports is not an inferior form of the culture, part of the culture.
No, it's part of it.
You can enjoy the opera and theater, as I do.
Yes.
But you can also enjoy the artistry of Michael Jordan playing basketball, or Chris Sale on the mound, or Walter Payton running the football. I mean, so it's part of the culture. But I thought the first part of what he said, the application, is interesting too, because there's so much to learn organizationally. From sports, you know, I mean, why, for example, I mean, just questions if you follow this. What is it that the St. Louis Cardinals do that no matter who, I mean, for 40 years, no matter who the manager is,
right,
no matter what injuries they suffer, they're always right there. They're always competitive. You know, you can understand the Yankees, particularly in recent times, because they've got a financial advantage, which allows them to pay for talent that small market teams can't. But how do the St. Louis Cardinals do it over and over and over and over again? They're always right there. They're always competitive. There's never the finishing last place. Not in recent memory.
No, I can't remember last time.
From the 80s forward, certainly.
Because of management? Is it because of their fans? Is it because of the facility? Is it because of camaraderie?
Corporate culture where, you know, you can change out some of the individuals, both on the field and in the front office, but the culture doesn't change, and it's a winning culture. You could say the same thing about the Pittsburgh Steelers, my team.
Yep.
And the Rooney family. What's the one constant been for the Steelers for my lifetime? The Rooney family. They institute the corporate culture, and you can go from a Chuck Noll to a Bill Cowher to a Mike Tomlin. You can change out the quarterbacks. You can change out the running backs. But you're always putting a competitive, if not superior, product on the field. It's interesting. I mean, you want to look at successful organizations and the attributes of those organizations to think about the organizations you're a part of in your life. I mean, there's right. It's sort of value systems and approaches to problem solving that are fungible. So I think it's really interesting to look at sports because it gets so much scrutiny. There's a lot to take away from it. And so this new book called Astro Ball, I'm sure many of you saw Moneyball, the movie. If you haven't read the Michael Lewis book, you saw the movie with Brad Pitt playing Billy Bean.
Right, yeah, I did see that movie.
And it was very good. This book review in the Claremont Review of Books, Moneyball Revisited, Ben Ryder, who's an SI sports writer for Sports Illustrated, the book is Astro Ball, and it's how the Houston Astros, who are in the ALCS right now battling the Boston Red Sox, went from the worst team in baseball to world champions last year. Something, by the way, that Ben Ryder predicted in a cover piece he did on the Astros for Sports Illustrated and was laughed at. But there was something going on. Astro executives, Jeff Lunau, who's the GM, Sig Mejdal, took Moneyball, the analytics,
right,
the sabermetrics that were so celebrated, Billy Bean, the Oakland A's, and merged the quantitative with the qualitative. So where Moneyball, if you remember, was all about quantitative, for example, looking at statistics that were underappreciated, like on-base percentage. So Billy Bean focused on those things with the kind of back office green eye shades guys and was able to identify and cobble together a talented team that complemented one another and found, you know, real success. Not world championship success, but real success nonetheless. The Astros front office guys sought to, as I said, synthesize quantitative and qualitative information about players and displayed, as the book reviewer recounts in Ryder's book, displayed the courage to fail badly in order to rebuild its farm system. One of the executives, Mejdal, says, it's either the scouts or the nerd in the corner of the room, but from the very beginning in St. Louis, they moved from St. Louis to Houston, Jeff framed it as an and question, the nerd in the corner of the room and the scouts, how to combine both of them. And he created this program called Stout, half stats, half scouts, synthesizing human observations into probabilistic models and made the human beings, the scouts, responsible for triaging and sometimes rejecting the results. And this is how they started to identify young stars that are now central to their team, like Dallas Keuchel and Jose Altuve, George Springer, Carlos Correa. Now, they haven't always been right. They gave up on J.D. Martinez to the Astros, who's now an MVP candidate for the Boston Red Sox, the team they're facing. But it's just interesting that they took this celebrated model, and rather than just replicating, they said, well, there's this human element, too. And so thinking about political parties, for example, since that's more of our stock and trade, mm-hmm. There's quantitative and there's qualitative. There's quantitative, the credentials, the money you can raise, the money you can write if you're going to be a candidate. But there's qualitative, too. You know, you take somebody who doesn't have political savvy, hasn't been in politics before, can't write a big check, but you see talent there, and so it's that quantitative plus qualitative. Is this district winnable? How does this person fit in this district or in this state? What are these person's attributes in this matchup against the competition? So there's in a world, I just think, where everything we do, we think is in the modern era, can be answered for us by an algorithm. There is, or AI is going to supplant mankind. There is this qualitative element. and you see people taking technology and marrying it to the qualitative human judgment call and finding great success in sport, which can, of course, be translated into virtually any other sector, the way that so many front or C-suite guys have been obsessed for the last decade by Moneyball and sabermetrics, right?
Right.
By the way, interestingly enough, Jeff Luhnow is a Northwestern MBA. So, you know, they're bringing these guys out of B school that go into sports, and this is managerial ethos that can be applied outside of sports too. So you could take the lessons from Theo Epstein's leadership and reshaping the Cubs. Same thing. So sports is important more for than just kind of passive, mindless enjoyment or remembering your glory days as a high school athlete or something like this. I mean, it has some real application and interesting applications in your life. And
it really, it is all about the coaching, I say often.
As a coach, yeah. And that's why.
That's always joke riding. You know, good job, girls, way to go. It's really all about the coaching.
Exactly. And the front office.
Since which is
I own your volleyball teams.
You do.
I'm like a one-man Rooney family.
Before you see it on TV, share it on Facebook, or read about it in the paper, hear it here first. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
The following is a paid political announcement.
Radical protests storm Washington. Far-left extremists demanding their way or the highway.
And you don't give power to an angry left-wing mob.
Standing with them, Senator Joe Donnelly. Donnelly says he's one of us, yet time after time he stands with them. Voting against Brett Kavanaugh to be on the Supreme Court. Voting against President Trump's historic tax cuts. And Donnelly claims to be full of common sense. But he voted for the reckless nuclear deal with Iran that makes us less safe. Senator Donnelly, he just isn't who he says he is. Mike Braun is a political outsider, job creator, and doer. Mike Braun's one of us. He'll help President Trump make the tax cuts permanent, and he'll vote to confirm conservative judges like Brett Kavanaugh. On Election Day, stand with Mike Braun for Senate.
I'm Mike Braun, and I approve this message.
Paid for by Mike Braun for Indiana.
Balance of Nature's fruits and veggies in a capsule.
I'm definitely feeling better because now that I'm feeling better, I have more energy to be able to do more things. Before, I was in severe pain with my back, and I couldn't do, I really couldn't function without taking an ibuprofen. And I haven't had to do that.
The first day, energy level was up by about 30%. Stamina was probably up 40%. Alertness was probably 20-25%. Afternoons, I'd get groggy, doggy. Just in 2 days, that is gone.
For a limited time, use discount code CHICAGO, and we'll take 35% off your first preferred set of fruits and veggies and have them shipped to you free. Call 800-246-8751 or go online to balanceofnature.com and use discount code CHICAGO.
Upstream-ideas.com, premium content that complements what we do each morning on this show. Against the Current, a long-form interview series with opinion leaders and policymakers. This week, it's posted my sit-down with Chicago Tribune columnist John Cass for a little midterm election preview. You want to get John's insights, make his perspicacity your own with your friends, then check out the interview I did with Mr. Cass, upstream-ideas.com. The sister site, defendhomeowners.com, and I would also add saveyourhomenow.org. Updated property tax information, or updated home sales information in your community, and then you can get a free property tax report on your actual home to understand what the highest property taxes in the nation are doing to home value, to understand the opportunity cost you're paying with the property tax system here versus, say, Indiana. So all the property tax info, the stories about property taxes decimating people's home values, defendhomeowners.com, saveyourhomenow.org, and then the Cass interview and everything else, upstream-ideas.com.
Is your sump pump working?
Are you sure? Hi, I'm Roy Spencer of PermaSeal. After every big storm, we get calls from distressed homeowners whose basements have flooded because their pump equipment failed. And they, too, assume that they were safe because it worked last time. At PermaSeal, we know the only way to ensure your pumps are in working order is to test them every day. Introducing the Basement Defender, the only device that will actively test your pumps and alert you to any problems every day. The Basement Defender will also monitor the temperature and humidity of your basement or crawl space, which will help avoid frozen pipes and costly mold issues. Our Basement Defender customers have the ultimate peace of mind. They know that their pump equipment is working, allowing them to rest peacefully during storms. You deserve that same peace of mind. Call PermaSeal and ask about the Basement Defender. 800-421-SEAL or visit permaseal.net.
Your best for being better, PermaSeal.
AM 560, The Answer.
Oh, yeah. You know the song, everybody.
Don't cry.
Sunny day.
Speaking of culture. Yeah.
Can you tell me how to get to Sesame Street?
Who's your favorite character?
What's that?
Who's your favorite character?
Oscar the Grouch, obviously.
Oh, mine was Big Bird because I was big like a bird.
They're both retiring because they were both performed by the same actor, Carol Spinney.
Yeah, I've been there since 1969.
84 years old. He's finishing his work on Sesame Street this week. And then new actors will assume the roles of Big Bird and Oscar the Grouch and other characters that he played. So the end of an era obviously recalls a simpler time, an innocent time when I was a child.
Oh, yeah.
For I was corrupted by the world. I do have, speaking of being corrupted by the world, I've got a suggestion for a replacement for Oscar the Grouch.
Who do you think?
I think Stinky the Grouch would be a better 21st century version of, part of the cast for Sesame Street, just more appropriate. You know, Stinky the Grouch.
I don't believe your pappy may be rich, but he ain't happy. Tells you about work and you want to be him. But when's the last time you got to see him? Works hard, why? So you can go out and buy a bunch of that you don't need. Driven by your punk hopes and greed. That's why I say it. For the first time in my life.
Yeah, kids like
I'm
this.
Finally free. No mansion for me. I say
Hey.
No brand new Humvee, I say it.
But you'll get no
I like Stinky's attitude.
Is I make love to my hand. So I don't need you, honey. I beat my like
okay.
Holds me all
right.
Money.
What?
Stinky is expressing himself.
That's right, I say. Excuse me, I'm going to make me a nice feces sandwich.
We want kids to express themselves and to learn that life is real, and I think Stinky does a nice job.
Yeah, Stinky, then who's going to be the awkward flightless bird?
I don't know. The Chappelle Show didn't do an awkward flightless bird. They just did Stinky. That's all I got.
If you're talking about it, I'll be talking about it. Dennis Prager here. Join me this morning at 11, right here on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. A lot of comparisons made by people of President Trump to President Reagan.
President Trump is comparing and has compared himself several times to President Reagan.
I don't think Trump compares favorably as a communicator to President Reagan.
No, but...
But I'll tell you what, he compares favorably with some policies, and frankly, we'll see, but I suspect Supreme Court nominees. Remember Sandra Day O'Connor and Anthony Kennedy. I would say Gorsuch and Kavanaugh will turn out to be considerably more originalist than were Reagan's choices. Of course, Native Son, Tampico, and Dixon, Illinois, Eureka College.
Did you say Tampico or Tampico?
I can say it either way.
Okay. I'm a Tampico myself, but all right.
Eureka College, where he played football.
Oh, yes.
We've got a new look at Reagan's journey from Bob Spitz, journalist and author of the book Reagan, An American Journey. Bob, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
My pleasure, Dan. Nice to be here.
So what stands out to you with respect to Reagan's life in his kind of formative years prior to his ascent to the presidency or even governor of California?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, he was a humble guy. He came from very humble backgrounds, as you mentioned, Tampico and Dixon. By the way, Amy, the people there call it Tampico.
All right.
Exactly. Thank you, Bob.
You know, and he, sorry about that.
Okay.
But he, you know, he came from an incredibly humble background, and he, his father was probably the only Democrat in town. And Reagan grew up, you know, a fan of Franklin D. Roosevelt and all of his liberal policies. So it was a kind of a unique conversion to watch over the course of, you know, nearly 9 decades, how this man gravitated from the left to the right and really formed his own impressions of government and the country and kind of instilled conservatism into the Oval Office.
How did his father's alcoholism affect him in his early life in religious faith?
Well, you know, I mean, I think it alienated him from the outside world. Because of that, Reagan was very circumspect about making friends. He didn't have many friends as a kid, nor in college. And oddly enough, even in his adult years, he really never got close to people. I think, you know, not just his father's conservatism, but his mother's real piousness and involvement in their own things kept him separate and apart. And he realized that he had to pull himself up by his own bootstraps. So I think that's one of the real reasons for his success. He realized it was all up to him. He had to make it on his own. And, you know, he really succeeded at 4 very different and difficult professions.
One of my favorite stories about Reagan has nothing to do with his life as an actor or politics, and I wonder if you're familiar with it. It was actually told, where I heard it was from Mark Shields, of all people, liberal. Reagan, when he was a football player at Eureka College, they're going to play a neighboring school. They stop at the hotel that their players are going to stay at overnight before the game the next day. Two of the players on the team were black. The innkeeper wouldn't allow them to stay. So Reagan borrowed money from the coach, and he took a cab back to his home in Dixon with the two players. They had dinner and stayed at his home and then came back the next day for the football game. And just sort of that simple act of being decent to other human beings, standing up when you know something is wrong and standing on the side of people who are being wronged, I thought just said so much about the young man that has nothing to do with politics. And so it tells you about character.
Well, that's true. And you've told the story beautifully. That's exactly how it happened. Luckily, I was able to talk to some of the people who remembered that scene. And in the book, I actually put you there on that bus as Reagan confronts the coach and tells the coach he has a better plan for these two teammates of his. And he does it so gently so that the two black kids don't feel like they're being outcasts. He said there wasn't enough room for 3 of them at the hotel. So he included himself. And really, they took a cab almost 30 miles away so that the boys could really feel like they hadn't been excluded. It's a wonderful story, and it tells you so much about who Reagan was and what he would become. And you know, throughout his life, he was violently opposed to segregation. He never veered from that.
So how did he go from, you know, humble upbringing from the Midwest to splashy, flashy California?
Well, you know, he went through the really through the heartland. He got a job after school. Well, after school, he didn't know what he was going to do. And it looked like he was going to take a job at Montgomery Ward. And that would have been the end of the Ronald Reagan story. But he always wanted to be a sportscaster. I mean, it wasn't even on the horizon for him, but he just decided to follow his dream. So he made the rounds of stations in the Midwest, and in Iowa, he got his chance. He got his foot in the door, and soon enough, he wedged the rest of himself in as well. And within about 6 months, Ronald Reagan had become the voice of the Midwest. He was on one of the Clear Channel stations. And people from eight states listened to Dutch Reagan, as he was called, every night. He did the Cubs games, and he followed the Cubs out to spring training in California and thought, you know, while I'm out here, I'm just going to cruise over to Warner Brothers. And I recreate that whole scene of him driving over there, getting his foot in the door and getting a screen test. And boy, that's all she wrote.
From your book, I wonder how you would convey Reagan's continuing relevance today. One thing I point to would be his 1964 A Time for Choosing speech at the Republican National Convention, because as he pointed out, freedom requires eternal vigilance, and so every generation has its own time for choosing. So that, to me, remains sort of timeless. But I wonder what your perspective is on Reagan's relevance today.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. But I think more than anything, and it's what draws people to this book right now, is that they're very eager to hear about a time when there was much more civility in Washington. Mm. You know, Reagan was able to reach across the aisle and work with Democrats and to compromise. I mean, he fought like cats and dogs with Tip O'Neill, who was the Democratic Speaker of the House. And yet, you know, every evening there was a detente, there was a ceasefire, and he and O'Neill would get together like two 70-year-old Irishmen and dip into his liquor cabinet and talk about policy and how they would get policy passed in our government. And I think that was the key to Reagan's success. I mean, he worked with the other side, he compromised and got things done.
Women always love to read about great love stories. What was his active love life in Hollywood? What was that like?
Oh, it was pretty hot and heavy. You know, he married Jane Wyman, who was an Oscar-winning actress. And when that marriage failed, Reagan was kind of a studly guy. You know, he was a handsome man.
Yeah, he was gorgeous.
You'll see on the cover of the book, it's a picture of him when he was, you know, 34 years old. He's looking tanned and muscled, and he was he made the rounds. But once he married Nancy, that was kind of the love affair for ages, and he never strayed.
Who should play Reagan in the remake of King's Row?
You know, that I hope they never remake King's
Yeah,
Row.
There you go. That's the correct answer. Very good. Bob Spitz, yeah. He is a journalist and author of Reagan, An American Journey, the book Reagan, An American Journey. Bob, thanks so much for joining us. Good luck with the book.
My pleasure. Thanks so much, Dan.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Connect with Dan and Amy on the AM 560 The Answer mobile app. Just text the word app to 64636 to download the app today. AM 560 The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Hey, some good news. It doesn't have to be until death do you part anymore.
Oh, really?
And I'm not talking about divorce. I'm talking about the other side of it. I'm talking about immortality. Well, sort of. Thanks to a sex doll rental company.
Wait.
Yeah. The innovators. UK's UK's first sex doll rental services is offering to make a replica of your dead lover.
So that you can
continue to enjoy one another's company.
And have conversations with them?
Mm-hmm.
And do other things with them? Gross. Well,
would you like to make a replica of your spouse? 312-642-5600 turnkey.pro answer line. 646-36DA turnkey.pro text line. And I mean an anatomically correct replica. Wouldn't that be nice? You could actually, I mean, you don't have to wait till your spouse dies either. I'm thinking you could use it now. Some people perhaps would rather be with a facsimile than the actual. I don't know. Just saying, it provides some versatility for the relationship, you know? Mm-hmm. Mixes things up, keeps things exciting. Jade Stanley says business is booming now that she's offering these, well, sex doll replicas of people. We've got a lot of people who approach us who have dolls made that resemble a partner they've lost. It can be very beneficial for them and helps them keep a piece of their loved one.
Oh.
It provides them with comfort, and people don't always buy the dolls for a sordid reason, Amy, if you get your mind out of the gutter for a moment. We even get couples who want to experience a threesome, but maybe okay. feel uneasy about seeing their partner with another person. If you just,
what is going on in this world? Are you being serious? They want to have a menage a trois with a robot?
This is a New York Post piece. This is serious business. It's also great for people who maybe feel socially awkward about approaching the opposite sex. What is that number? Let me see.
Write it down there. Yeah. That's your homework assignment. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
Mm-hmm.
I'm appalled.
She
whole sex bot thing is a big deal. I guess.
Jade Stanley already owns a chain of tanning salons, was hooked on the idea of sex dolls after reading about the industry in a newspaper article just a year and a half ago. You know, I was really interested, but found that the competition was mainly offering the dolls in a more sexualized way, and it was quite seedier for their own satisfaction. I wanted to approach it from a different angle, more to help people that are seeking comfort and may find it difficult in social situations to approach others. It's an incredibly discreet service, you know. So, these bespoke dolls, as they're called, sounds very regal and dignified. You know, bespoke, because they're
bespoke.
They can cost up to about $5,200, but they can be made to any specification. You can choose hair color, eye color, nail color, weight, even if they have scars, moles, or tattoos.
Height, too, all that.
Yeah. Yeah. Hmm. What do you think? Would you get a replica of a loved one that you could continue to enjoy their relationship after they pass?
Am I going to get in trouble for logging onto this website? I mean, do these things want, or do you have to carry them around? How does this work? I don't understand this whole thing.
Well, these are all very good questions that you can ask at the seminar we're attending on the topic.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Kevin in Northfield, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
I have a way to make some coin. I have reached out to Edward James Olmos, asking him if he wishes to buy an Amy replica doll, and he went nuts. He's all over it, and I can charge whatever I want.
Thanks for the call, Kevin. That is so gross. You know what's more gross than the sex doll?
What?
Edward James Olmos.
Okay, just...
Kelly...
It's in the 90s. Just leave me alone.
Kelly in Racine, Wisconsin.
Hey, Dan, will they put a Jamaican accent on my lady's body because she's Jamaican?
Thanks for the call, Kelly.
Crazy.
Zing. I think the great thing about these sex dolls is they don't talk, right?
Yeah. You don't have to worry about, you just carry them around with you. That's the weird part. You know, we had an event once, and a guy had, he had a mannequin in a wheelchair, and he was carting her around like it was his wife.
Yeah.
And there was no life there.
Didn't
he
you ever
bought
see...
bought Uggs for her and introduced us to her.
You're a Ryan Gosling fan, right?
Yeah.
Didn't you ever see the movie Lars and the Real Girl?
Oh, yeah.
He was ahead of his time. You know, life imitating art. Ugh. Perry and Niles.
I love this idea.
okay. You like
I'm
it
imagining
too much,
an old woman with, and she's got an old man doll, naked, like 90 something years old, and it's just in time for Halloween. She's not using them, she could put them out in a rocking chair on the front porch.
All right, Perry. Thanks for the call. I think Perry and Niles is a good reason why Jade Stanley thinks her business is going to really take off. I don't know why you would imagine elderly people naked.
No one wants it. You get a younger version of what they used to be.
You relive
the glory days. Sagging skin. Who needs to see that? Okay, are we done now?
Don't ask me. Ask Edward James Olmos.
Oh, gross.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Know about the discrimination suit filed by a handful of staffers against Spalding and his running mate Stratton. This other story, though, is interesting. I mean, they were both sort of under the rubric of the left cannibalizing the left. 40th Ward, Aldermanic Ward, candidate for him on Tuesday night, was not too friendly to incumbent alderman Pat O'Connor.
No, it was not.
This in Edgewater, the moderator, talk about walking into a bit of a buzzsaw, the moderator of the forum, one writer, Rick Perlstein.
Have you ever heard of him?
No.
Me neither.
Tweeted after the event, "Now that I'm not moderator, I can immoderately report that Alderman Pat O'Connor of the 40th Ward is a racist troll who's morally unfit for public office for accusing his Nigerian-American opponent of not being for the community but for Nigerians." Here's the exchange, and this is important in the context of the mayor's race, which I'll explain again momentarily. Here's what Alderman Pat O'Connor said.
"First and foremost, your comments show how little you do know about what goes on in the city of Chicago. In the city of Chicago, voted for that investment in the West Side on the same day that they voted for that for the Obama Library on the South Side. It was a historic day in the African American community. Now, if you want to talk about when you run for community, this is your fundraising invitation. It doesn't talk about community. It talks about building Nigerian power in Chicago. Now, I mean, for God's sake, if you want to talk about being part of a community and this is how you're going to raise your money, I can't understand how you expect that.
And this is about him supporting the building of the police academy, which apparently the audience didn't support. Mm-hmm. His opponent, one of the opponents he's referencing, is a gentleman named Ugo Okeri. He's the Nigerian American. He responded to O'Connor.
"Alderman O'Connor, I would like you to reread what was on that flyer, because what it said on that flyer was Nigerian political power. And guess what? There are different constituencies across the city of Chicago. Every single one deserves political power. Every single one. You cannot do it. They say that some people deserve more than others and act as if we have equal political power in the city of Chicago. No, that's not true."
So O'Connor was a racist for suggesting that Okeri is engaged in identity politics, focusing on Nigerian political power to the exclusion of sort of a unified vision of community. And then Okeri confirms that's what he was doing.
Right.
Let me tell you something. So now O'Connor is facing the Boo Birds and the identity politics mob, and I have zero sympathy for him, just as I have zero sympathy for Spalding and Stratton, because this is the politics the left plays. And now it is...
They're eating their own.
That's correct. Now it's turning on them, because somebody can always intersectionality you one better. And that's what they're facing. And so this goes back to Chance the Rapper's press conference this week and all of the discussion by the political press corps in this city. How can we bring the city together? How can we bring the city together to face our challenges together, to forge solutions together? Okay, so who's going to be the black candidate? Who's going to be the Irish candidate? Who's going to be the Nigerian candidate? Who's going to be the Latino candidate? Who's going to be the Latina candidate?
And who's going to be the Greek candidate?
Yeah, right.
Don't forget about the Greeks.
John Cass, he's running. Yeah. So square the circle for me to help us do that, in addition to talk about his presentation before the City Club this week of his financial plan for the city of Chicago, is former CPS superintendent and mayoral candidate Paul Vallis. Paul, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Well, thanks for having me. That was a good wake-up call this morning.
Well, I mean, here's the thing. I know you want to focus on dollars and cents, and that's super important in the worst-governed city in the country, major city. But the racial politics can't be ignored, and I want to get your comment on what you heard in that O'Connor 40th Ward candidate forum and what you heard from Chance the Rapper this week in announcing his endorsement and just the balkanization of our continued balkanization of Chicago by race and you know, gender and orientation and every other identity.
Well, you know, that's a lot to handle in just about 5 or 6 minutes. But, you know, at the end of the day, I kind of ignore it all, quite frankly. I mean, you know, if I'm going to be categorized or labeled or whatever, I just my approach is just, you know, to identify what the real problems are and to offer solid solutions and to go out there and talk to people about them. You know, when I ran the Chicago Public Schools, I didn't experience the racial politics or any racial animosity or, you know, I've worked in districts that were overwhelmingly minority, overwhelmingly poor. And, I had few, if any, days where I really felt that there was balkanization, in part because my approach was to be honest and direct with people and offer them real solutions. When I go into the communities, the poorest communities in the city, I don't get shouted down about my support for building a police academy, if not a bigger and a better police academy than the one they have proposed. People want to know about why their neighborhoods are not safe enough, why there aren't enough cops, why their response to 911 is not quick enough, their high property taxes, their killer fees and fines, and the lead in the water. And the fact that, their schools are substandard, and if they can't get their kid into a magnet school, somehow they feel they've got to either move out of the city or find some other way to get their kid into a quality school.
Well,
those are the things that I hear time and again in all the communities.
And I'll tell you what, that's an answer. You know what that answer is? That's the answer, I think, how most people actually live their lives on a daily basis. There is no racial discord. There is no identity discord, but it gets whipped up by organizations that have an interest in doing it and amplified by a media that has an interest in doing it. And so, I mean, I guess one way to do it is just lead by example, like you're suggesting. That's a fair answer.
Yeah, you know, that's right. You just have to plow on. And sometimes people resort to those type of things in part because they don't have answers and they don't have solutions.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I've been to more community. When I go into the community, even when I'm talking to some of the biggest advocates, some of the most vocal advocates, you know, I don't even think that I've had a bad day. Now, I'll have plenty of bad days before this campaign is over. But, you know, when I explain to them that, yes, this is why we need a police academy, but you know what? And this is why we need more cops. But, you know, we also need a stronger infrastructure. We also need better training. We also need to have the right sergeant ratio so that we have the right supervision. And we also have to take advantage of the, you know, 9,000 ROTC cadets that we have in the Chicago Public Schools, and perhaps they can be the next generation of police officers and firefighters and paramedics, and so that the police department over the years can become more reflective of the community in a natural, organic way. And when I say those type of things, you know, I don't get shouted down. People don't accuse me of, you know, being pro-police and anti-community. People listen. People want answers.
And you know about this, too, because your wife's a police officer and both of your sons are police officers, correct?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And they're great cops. And my boys are wonderful cops. They're wonderful police officers. And as you know, my older son was a combat medic with the 5th Marines. He was in combat. And my younger boy was in the Marine Corps. And they're just extraordinary. They love being police officers. They are well received by the communities that they serve in.
All right, now let's talk about your financial plan, black and white in terms of numbers, not in terms of race. Your plan includes $250 million in additional property tax increases over the next 5 years, while instituting a cap at 5% or the rate of inflation, whichever is less. As part of that. So, I mean, you know, pr- property tax is sort of a bete noire of mine because it's destroying and driving people, destroying the city, the state, driving people out of here. $250 million increase in property taxes against the backdrop of the highest property taxes in the nation in the context of an $8 billion budget. You can achieve savings and restructuring and shrinking of government elsewhere to prevent from the need for more property tax increases?
Well, what I did was I looked at three things. First of all, my approach is, and my approach on all of my budgets has been to lay out multi-year budgets, like five-year plans. That's how I turned a $1 billion structural deficit in Chicago Public Schools into $1 billion in cash balances when I left, and 13 bond rating upgrades, and operating in a property tax cap that I've recommended for the city. But basically what I've said is, look, you know, we're going to have some sort of an agenda at the state level that's real and practical that can be phased in over 5 years. And the things I've articulated are all things that are there and things that are doable. And then I've laid out a whole series of measures to bring spending under control over the next 5 years, so that instead of asking property taxpayers to finance the remaining pension obligations at which are well over $1 billion, because that's how much they're going to have to increase. That's how much they're going to have to increase funding for pensions because of the state mandates. I've said what I'd like to do is I want to be able to accomplish these other things on the state and on the spending side so that we can, in effect, limit property tax increases to 5% or the rate of inflation, whichever is less. And that's individual increases. So whether you're a homeowner or your business, for that matter, or you're a landlord, you're never going to see your property taxes. The rate of inflation has been about 2 to 3%. You're never going to see your property taxes grow by more than 2 or 3%. I think that would be a reasonable approach to take over a 5 year period. And that's the way we have to, that's the way we have to approach it. And what I've tried to do, as you can see by my city club speech, is to be very specific in articulating the areas, for example, that I would cut and some of the ideas I have at the state level, as well as what I would do on the revenue side.
Well, I mean, I appreciate your candor and saying, you know, just telling us like it is. But I am, as a Chicagoan for the past 22 years, I am so sick of paying higher property taxes. I feel like I'm paying for the sins of the politicians, the people that were irresponsible in the past. And is there any other way you can do it besides raising our property taxes?
Well, yeah, I mean, there is. Going to get in a constitutional amendment to have the ability to negotiate pension funding compromises and then have them stick and not have the very political Supreme Court overrule them time and time again is the most direct way to do that. You know, so but short of that, you've got to be realistic and you've got to be practical. Look, Emmanuel's raised property taxes and a combination of other taxes and fees by $1.5 billion. You know, and they're going to be facing another property tax increase of that size. What I'm trying to do is to lay out a strategy to minimize those increases. And I think if you go to taxpayers and you say, look, we can solve the city's financial problems while at the same time creating conditions so that we can have enough police officers in the community. We can have the type of economic development investment in all communities so that we can begin to grow the city, because the city's declining. The city's lost 17% of its residential property tax wealth just because of the declining city. I mean, if somebody said we can do this and never raise taxes beyond the rate of inflation or 5%, whichever is less, and again, it's been historically the last 10 years been about 2 to 3%, I think people would consider that to be prudent financial management. But, you know, I've never been one to present proposals that were not substantive. Those are the conditions that I can create, I believe.
Well, just in terms of what's realistic, though, you also suggest new revenue from Chicago casino, from legalization of recreational marijuana. So dope and gambling is our path to prosperity.
Well, the reality is, they're going to legalize cannabis. Yeah. So I think the point that I'm making is if they're going to legalize it, let's make sure we get our fair share of tax revenue. Because, you know, in the past, the state will pretend it's like a lottery. We're going to legalize cannabis and the money's going to go into the school funding formula. And you know, we're going to get that, then it's going to be smoke and mirrors, and then it's not going to have an impact whatsoever. So I'm going to say, if it is going to be legalized, we might as well get a share of the revenue like they've done in Colorado and other states. And at the end of the day, too, you know, if we have an opportunity to basically get a casino, let's take advantage of it, and let's secure the money so that we can use some of that money to avoid property tax increases. But I'm not offering those as single solutions. What I've done is, at the state level, is lay out an agenda of five or six things, because I believe we need to go to the state with an agenda. Local governments are always screwed, pardon the expression, when it comes to state action. The state's always imposing more mandates on local governments,
yeah, right,
while not giving them the revenues to support those mandates. So I'm trying, based on my 12 years experience in Springfield, I'm trying to articulate what we can get from Springfield so we can minimize the need to raise local property taxes.
With respect to the schools, we understand from Econ 101 that competition improves goods and services and lowers costs. So what about increasing competition within CPS to do just that?
Well, as you know, I'm if you read the blogs, there are some people who think I invented charter schools. And in New Orleans, we created the nation's first 100% school choice district. So, you know, I've been a supporter of school choice. I've been supportive of traditional public school choice. You know, so I've never been a wallflower on those type of issues. The challenge that they have in the schools, obviously, is the fact that they've lost 70,000 students since I departed the Chicago Public Schools, I might add. Mm-hmm. And because they have not made the schools attractive enough, because there are too many substandard schools. And, you know, I think the decline of the schools, and the city colleges have lost one-third of their population, is also having an impact on the city and is also resulting in people voting with their feet, which is moving out of the city. So at the end of the day, you know, I've supported competition. I always have. And I believe that we can make the schools better. And I think we can make the schools better within the context of the available revenues. Look, we all want more money, and we all want the state to fully fund the school aid formula that they just enacted. But at the end of the day, just as I was able to straighten out the school's financial problems when I was a CEO and left the schools with 12 bond rating upgrades, I'm pretty confident that given the present financial situation, I'm going to be able to perform with a similar level of success when I become mayor.
All right. He is Paul Vallis, a former CEO of CPS, candidate for mayor of Chicago in February. Paul, thanks as always for joining us. Appreciate it.
And thanks so much for giving me the time, and have a great day to you and your listeners.
All right. Thank you,
thanks,
sir.
Thanks, Paul. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's like a hot, steaming cup of information to start your day. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Coming up next, it's me, Mike Gallagher, right after Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy, and excellent piece in the Wall Street Journal from Jason Riley. Gosnell, like its namesake, faces a media blackout. He points to the Gosnell film released last week. Cracked the top 10 box office receipts for its opening weekend, despite completely being ignored. I mean, it was difficult enough to get to theaters. Now it's completely ignored. Try and see it in Chicago. You can't. You have to go to an outlying suburb around here. Jason Riley goes to the case of this Philadelphia abortionist who was convicted of murder in 2013, serving a life sentence in prison, no possibility of parole. He recounts how the movie was treated very much like Gosnell's trial in 2013, with the national media ignoring it, other than Fox News. The liberal press, writes Riley, knew the story would cast a negative light on abortion, and that concerned them much more than bringing to justice a doctor who committed infanticide and routinely risked the health of women. Ultimately, social media shamed the press into covering the trial, but you won't be shocked to find out that the interest in the story hasn't lasted. Some outlets have refused to run ads for the film, and almost all major publications have declined to review it, which explains why I had so little company on Friday, writes Riley, when he went to see it the day it opened. For more on this and a couple of other matters of cultural import, we're pleased to be joined again by our friend Andrew Klavan. He's a podcaster in addition to a Hollywood screenwriter, Another Kingdom. He's also, in addition to true crime, which was made in, Clint Eastwood made into a movie. He's the screenwriter for the Gosnell movie. Andrew Klavan, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Always great to be here. Thanks.
So what about the completely unsurprising entertainment press treatment of the Gosnell movie?
Well, it's actually kind of interesting because they could have chosen what they do with most pro-American, Christian, or anti-abortion films. They could have just chosen to rip into it, but instead they chose to absolutely ignore it, which is what they did to the trial in the first case. Mm-hmm. And what's fascinating to me about this is you could take a point of view that says, look, this is not a film about abortion. This was a guy who was murdering children. The children were born. He didn't really know what he was doing, so he would deliver the children and then kill them. And that's murder in anyone's book. I mean, most states have a limitation on abortion up at 20 weeks, which is, 5 months, which is appalling anyway. But this was way, way beyond that. So they could have just said, well, this is not abortion. This is an infanticide. And, of course, we all agree it's against the law. And we're not going to talk about abortion in this case, which is kind of what the judge said when she wanted to try the case. But instead they ignored it, which really speaks to me about a sense of guilt and shame about what they're supporting in the first place. They could have made the argument that it wasn't about abortion, but they didn't because they know it is.
Well,
and that to me is what really reveals where they stand.
The other thing, though, too, is they want to continue to prop up the narrative that no abortionist is Kermit Gosnell and every pro-life activist is Eric Rudolph.
Well, that's right. You know, the scene in the movie that is the scene that kind of is a linchpin of the movie is when they try to bring forward a witness, the good abortionist, the person who doesn't do these things, who follows the law, and on the witness stand, and this was right out of the trial, I took this right out of the trial transcript, on the witness stand she describes what a real abortion looks like, and it doesn't look all that different from what Kermit Gosnell was doing. And I think that's why they cannot cover this story. They could make an argument, but they don't. They just turn their eyes, they put their hands over their eyes like the monkeys in the See No Evil trinity, and they just ignore it because once they start talking about it, they really have to confront what this is. And, you know, you only have to listen to the kinds of language that Planned Parenthood and other pro-abortion people use when they talk about women's health care and a woman's right to choose. And, you know, even the word abortion is kind of, a cleaned up word for what really is going on. I'm not going to describe the process because it's too disturbing to talk about on the air, but, it really is. So it's something that we need to confront in ourselves. It's something we need to ask ourselves about, right and left. We need to ask ourselves if we want a society that knows how to deal with unwanted children and how what to do with them, because it's not going to go away by us pointing fingers and screaming at one another. We need to develop a culture that welcomes children into the world and has a place for them.
Well, so this movie's about his 30-year killing spree and the political and media establishment that tried to cover it up. How is that portrayed in the film?
Well, it's an arrest and trial drama. You know, obviously, nobody wants to go to the movies and watch, gore and bloodshed, and that's not what we were trying to do at all. This is a story about an investigation and a trial, and, they worked very hard to make sure it had a PG-13 rating. But in the testimony and in the investigation, it comes out that this thing was reported again and again. There were complaints about this guy again and again. There's a stack of complaints that was big enough to make a 1,000-page book. Nobody wanted to go near it. They did not want to put abortion in a bad light. And so again and again, they closed their eyes to the abuse of poor women, the abuse of black women, the abuse of people who had nowhere else to go. And they just closed their eyes because they did not want this issue to come out. Everybody knew that you did not mess around with the abortion factory. And that was why it got covered up.
I don't ask this often, but I think it's an important question. The personal consequences, career consequences to you. I mean, you're somebody whose books have been optioned into huge movies, true crime, Clint Eastwood, Don't Say a Word. What is your outspokenness as a conservative and doing projects like this done to your standings, quote unquote, in Hollywood?
Well, there's no question. I don't know how much of it was intentional, but, you know, there's no way to tell. But there's no question that it curtailed my Hollywood career, which was for several years a very good one. I mean, I was selling multiple scripts in a year, and that all dried up the minute I started to speak my mind about political issues and issues like this. I have to be honest with you, though, I have never lost a minute's sleep over this. And the reason is I see the role of being a writer as the role of searching for and speaking the truth, even when you're telling stories, even when I'm making up crime dramas. I mean to tell the truth about what people are like and what they do to each other and how those systems work. And some there are some truths you can only tell by telling fiction, by telling stories. To live a life in which I'm curtailed in what I can say for fear that some fat cat producer isn't going to like me anymore, that's not a life I'm here to live at all. And so I just my view of my own work is not a careerist view. It's a view of trying to do something that appeals to people and entertains people, but also speaks to the real world insofar as I'm capable of doing it. So, you know, I'm not a martyr. I'm not a hero. You know, it's none of that stuff. I just do what I do. And if it costs me in Hollywood, that really does not keep me awake at
night
at all.
Is this one of your proudest projects? I mean, do you put your heart and soul into this? And tell me what you...
I have to tell you, the great Pulitzer Prize-winning cartoonist, Michael Ramirez, sent me a picture cartoon he had done of the Gosnell trial of babies in the guise of Holocaust victims behind a barbed wire fence, and I posted it above my desk. And every day that I sat down to write this script, I felt that presence there very powerfully. And I felt, I really felt like I had him sitting on my shoulder. I had to do a good job. I did the best I could. I'm proud of the way it came out. Nick Searcy, the actor, directed it, and he did a great job as well. But yeah, you know, that's something, you don't mess around. You're telling a true story. There are victims. There are people who are watching you from another plane, and you got to be responsible to them.
Outstanding. I want to get your take on the controversy du jour this week, Elizabeth Warren, a fellow maverick movie maker in Eli Steele, the son of the great Shelby Steele. Eli's great himself. He did this documentary, How Jack Became Black. We've had him on the show promoting his documentary, which is excellent. If you haven't seen it, you're missing out. He had a good piece at Fox News website yesterday, and he just asked this simple question. If we had spent the last 50 years moving toward character instead of skin color as a much more sensible way to define ourselves, would anyone outside of Warren's family and friends care about Warren's heritage? Why should they?
That is so true. By the way, that is a wonderful documentary, How Jack Became Black. It is so true that the entire system of identity politics is simply racism with a smiling face. And it is just, you know, when I talk to college kids, they always phrase their questions in terms of skin color. And it's like, it's not a question of being colorblind. We can all see what color people are. It's a question of moral apprehension. It's a question of saying, I choose to overlook this little sheath of skin that's on you, and I choose to look at you as an individual and make my decisions that way. And, you know, you can hear on TV this machinery for translating every single issue into race. You know, I mean, I was watching a news program where they were talking about Trump said something, oh, it's a dangerous time, a scary time for young men. And they translated it into, it's a scary time for young white men. And I thought, well, he didn't say that. It had nothing to do with that, you know.
Right.
You can disagree with him, but why does everything come down to this? Racism has always been a way of setting people against one another, of dividing people for reasons of power. It remains that in the form of identity politics. It's a way of turning Americans against one another so that they can make the argument that you need the government to take care of you. It's either right to look at people according to the color of their skin, or it's wrong. And I think it is obviously wrong, and we should just stop doing it, and we should stop allowing the press, which is the left, to do it as well.
Well, going back to President Trump and what he said, a scary time for young men, do you believe that it is?
I think what was scary, I think what was scary was the willingness to overthrow due process just to get at a judge, at Judge Kavanaugh. We've had this three times now. We've had the Bork hearing, we've had the Clarence Thomas hearing, and now we've had the Kavanaugh hearing, where the left is willing to do anything in order to keep the power to rewrite the Constitution from the words that are actually on the page into what they think should be there. And you do not see this. You do not see this the other way around. They can talk all they want about delaying Merrick Garland. They didn't try to destroy the guy's life. They voted for Elena Kagan. The GOP voted for Elena Kagan. They voted for Ruth Bader Ginsburg. They have not responded in kind because it's not the same argument. We're arguing for judges who will say what is in the Constitution, to play the referee over the laws that are passed. They're arguing for judges who will rewrite the Constitution as they feel it should have been written in the first place. That's a very different argument. And so they have to go after good judges and destroy their character and attack their lives. And the GOP simply doesn't do it. It doesn't happen. And so I think it was a scary time for America. I'm so happy it worked out the way it did, not just because I think Kavanaugh will be a decent judge, but because I think it was a beautiful thing to see politicians stand up to what was, in fact, a mob being encouraged by the press and by people in power to just destroy a guy without due process. That's scary. I think that's scary for everybody because anybody can be destroyed. Anybody can tell lies about you. You know, anybody, your ex-husband, your ex-wife can call your employer and start saying things. And if you don't have the presumption of innocence, you just can be destroyed so easily.
That's Andrew Klavan. And by the way, your answer to what it means to be a writer should be like cut and pasted and broadcast in every lit class at high school and college around the country. It was great. He's a podcaster, of course, Another Kingdom, a famed Hollywood screenwriter and the screenwriter for the Gosnell movie, The Trial of America's Biggest Serial Killer, which is in theaters somewhat near you, Woodridge, but find them.
Yeah, Woodridge, Addison, and Crestwood are the closest ones.
There you go. Find them in Chicagoland and elsewhere. Andrew Klavan, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks, love. Always a pleasure.
Yes, thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
You're listening to Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.